with us, University of Wisconsin-Madison Pre-Law Society students. Would they stand? Good seeing you all. I think some of your colleagues were here at an earlier session. You may be seated. The high school students are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar in this court. It's called Court with Class. High school students are invited to come to the court and listen to an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, they are sent materials relating to this case, and they may engage in some activities also relating to this case. They come and they listen to the oral argument and meet with the justice assigned to the arguments. And today it will be Justice Bradley, who is to my immediate right. The discussion will be on the procedures that the court has in taking and deciding cases, not the substantive issue of the case. Everyone's invited to attend the session, which will be right after this. Now, we ran over time in our last argument, and some justices may have to leave at approximately noon. They are not withdrawing from participation. It's nothing either counsel have said that offended the justice, and they will listen to the oral argument that they missed, so they are participating, and I don't want you to be distressed when the justice or justices leave. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Bradley. Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left, Justice Patience Robinsack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call the case 07AP2771-D, OLR versus Harvey Goldstein. Arguing for 25 minutes will be Julie Scott of the Office of Lawyer Regulation, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Ms. Scott.
May it please the court, my name is Julie Scott, and I represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation in the present disciplinary proceeding. The issue in this case is the appropriate sanction that this court should assess against Mr. Goldstein for his theft, intentional theft, of $69,500 when he was in a fiduciary role representing three estates. The referee recommended a one-year suspension of Mr. Goldstein's license. At the disciplinary proceeding, Mr. Goldstein argued for a two-year suspension of his license. The OLR recommendation or belief is that Mr. Goldstein's license should be revoked as a result of his misconduct. This court does not accord the referee's sanction recommendation conclusive or great weight. This court will impose whatever sanction it determines is appropriate to achieve the goals of the lawyer regulation system, regardless of the referee's recommendation. In determining the appropriate level of discipline, this court considers the seriousness of the misconduct, as well as the need to protect the public, the courts, and the legal system from a repetition of the misconduct, along with the need to impress upon the attorney the seriousness of his misconduct, and also to deter other attorneys from engaging in similar misconduct as well.
Counselor, I notice you characterize it as theft, and in the materials I read earlier, I think it was characterized as a conversion. Was there testimony at the hearing that he intended to keep these funds permanently, or was it a use of the funds inappropriately? I know they were all paid back, and I know there's no disagreement about that.
There's no direct evidence that he intended to keep the funds permanently. There is testimony that he intentionally took the funds from his trust account, which resulted in a conversion of those funds. He also was charged and found to have violated 20:8.4b in three counts for his theft of the funds by engaging in a criminal act.
He hasn't been proceeded on criminally, though, is that correct?
He has not.
Okay, thank you.
But the referee did find that he violated 20:8.4b, which is a criminal act.
Thank you.
How many counts did the referee find were violated here?
The referee found that there were 20 counts that Mr. Goldstein violated.
Were those all because of his stipulation that he had violated those sections at issue?
He did not stipulate to a violation of count 18, and the referee found that he did violate count 18. Otherwise, he had stipulated and pled no contest to the remainder of the accounts.
Well, is there an issue in regard to count 23?
Yes, there is an issue with regard to count 23. The OLR believes that there is sufficient evidence on the record to show that Mr. Goldstein did engage in misconduct in regards to count 23, which is a violation of SCR 20:4.2, as well as 20:8.4a. Essentially, Mr. Goldstein, in OLR's opinion, communicated with a client represented by counsel in violation of 20:4.2. He did this through the acts of another, an employee of Mr. Russo's, thus violating also 20:8.4a. In Mr. Goldstein's answer, if you take a look at the answer, he pled no contest to a majority of the complaint. He is essentially silent as to counts, I believe they're 94, 95, and 96. I can. The answer asserts that he pled no contest to all the counts up through 20, but not including count 18. Paragraph 8 of his answer denies the allegation that he engaged in misconduct under paragraph 105. But he does not dispute in his answer that he violated any of the factual allegations that led up to a violation of count 23 of the complaint.
This seems like a technical argument on behalf of the OLR to me. Sometimes technical arguments win, but did you ask the referee at the hearing to rely on these pleadings or pretrial brief statements as part of the record?
Lillard did not, as part of the record, ask the referee to find or
rely upon
the assumption that he violated those paragraphs in the complaint 96, 97, and 98. However, it is that no time during the proceeding did Mr. Goldstein allege that he didn't say anything other than that he informed the employee he would pay Mr. Russo soon. And if you look at the rules of motions and pretrial practice, under 802.02, a party shall state in short and plain terms the defenses to each asserted claim and shall admit or deny the averments upon which the adverse party relies. Denials shall fairly meet the substance of the averments denied. The pleader shall make the denials as specific denials of designated averments or paragraphs.
At the hearing, he contested that, though, didn't he?
He didn't contest it at the hearing. There were statements made at the hearing that he did not object to that were made. For example, if you look at the transcript,
Let me be more pointed, if I may.
Sure.
And that is, I thought that he said, he testified at the hearing that he said to the employee, tell Ron I said thanks for still doing business with me.
He testified that he said that. He never testified that he never said, also in addition to that, to tell Mr. Russo that he would pay him soon. And if you look at the record, there's a colloquy between myself and Referee Fiorenza.
Where in the record is that?
And we're looking at pages 98 through 99 of the transcript. And starting at line 24 on the bottom of page 98, Mr. Goldstein says, I was still doing business with Mr. Russo throughout all of this. And he goes into his statement that he said, tell Ron, I said, thanks for still doing business with me. Referee Fiorenza then said, is that what you're getting at? Ms. Falk, myself, said, well, the facts that he's admitted to is that he asked the employee to tell Russo he would soon pay him the money that he was owed after he, Referee Fiorenza then said, I think he's admitted that. Ms. Falk, myself, then says he's admitted that he's done that, but he's claiming that he didn't in mitigation of the rule violation, that he was acting as a party to a lawsuit as opposed to an attorney. At no point in time did Mr. Goldstein object to the statements made by myself and the referee that he admitted that he told Mr. Russo he would pay him soon. And then again, if you look at, I believe, the transcript, pages 103 through 104, there's a question by Mr. Kohler starting on page 103, line 20, where he says, why don't we just, then the question is by me, in order to violate 20:4.2, which is the violation which Mr. Russo communicated through a third party, I mean, I'm sorry, strike that, where Mr. Goldstein directed a third party to tell Russo that he would pay him the money owed. Does it matter in determining whether or not there was a rule violation, whether or not Mr. Goldstein was trying to dissuade Russo from pursuing the grievance? Then the answer was, the purpose of the communication is not determinative of a violation. There was no objection to that testimony or statements being made in the record as well. Also, if you look at Mr. Goldstein's pretrial brief, on page 2 of his pretrial brief, he argues count 23 is mitigated to the point of being de minimis. It alleges that Goldstein communicated with Russo, who was represented by counsel, by asking Russo's employee to tell Russo he would soon have the money owed. Goldstein's contact with Russo's employee was done while Goldstein was acting in the capacity of a party to a potential dispute, defendant or subject of a grievance, as opposed to acting in the capacity of a lawyer. There was no attempt by Goldstein to contact Russo directly or to dissuade him from pursuing the grievance. Therefore, according to the pretrial brief, he's not denying that he told Russo's employee that he would soon have the money owed. There was just an argument as to whether or not he was acting in the capacity as an individual versus as an attorney.
Let's assume that there had been no grievance filed against Mr. Goldstein here.
Yes.
Let us, as to the trust accounts and trust accounting, let us assume that the only grievance filed against him is that Russo had an attorney who was in a collection matter with Mr. Goldstein, and Mr. Goldstein said what it is alleged he said here, right?
Yes.
Just one, what would the OLR do with that kind of grievance?
The OLR would prosecute him for violating a 20:4.2.
What would be, you just take it on that, and what would be the recommendation for sanction?
It would, taking out the trust account?
Out of everything. What I'm trying, here's my point.
More than likely, it would be a I would say, a diversion or a private reprimand.
That's what I would say.
Essentially, that count really has no bearing on the ultimate sanction recommendation.
And that's my point.
Correct.
That's what I was going to say, and that's why you didn't start out with that. And so, whether you're right or Mr. Goldstein is right about the Russo account, it really is not going to affect the sanction.
That's correct, Justice Abramson.
And this complaint has numerous provisions, and it has a lot of counts. But as I read it, the first, 14 counts deal with, was it three estates, four estates?
Three estates.
And it's removing funds from the estates, using them for his personal benefit, and returning them to the estate without interest.
That's correct.
Is that a good summary?
Yes.
Okay. And then counts 15 through 20, I'll just summarize generally, and I hope somewhat accurately, are that he has not kept his trust accountings correctly. And yet, in one manner or other, from counts 15 to 20, he has failed these accountings requirements.
That's correct.
Okay. And then we're going to eliminate Russo. So we're left with conversion, as Justice Rogenczak pointed out, or theft, if that's you want. But anyway, there's been a taking here. And trust account failures. Right?
Correct.
And then there's really admissions as to the trust accounting takings.
Yes.
I mean, there's really not a dispute about that. And there's really not a dispute that his accountings are not up to snuff, whatever that means.
Right.
And the only question is there mitigation or excuses for the ultimate result that they're not up to snuff?
Correct.
All right. So, given that summary, you asked for revocation. The OLR asked for revocation.
Yes.
Referee has 1 year suspension, and the Mr. Goldstein asks for 2 years. So, what's the defense for revocation? How many? We usually look at the compendium and say, hey, we find comparable.
Right. Essentially, the OLR, in determining that they should seek a revocation with regard to Mr. Goldstein's case, looked at the ABA model, the standards, and also looked at comparable case law in Wisconsin. Under the ABA standards, the commentary indicates that some courts have held that disbarment is always the appropriate discipline when a lawyer knowingly converts client funds. Like many rules governing the behavior of lawyers, this one has its roots in the confidence and trust which clients place in their attorneys. Having sought his advice and relying upon his expertise, the client entrusts the lawyer with a transaction, including the handling of the client's funds. Whatever the meaning may be for the lawyer's handling of client's money, the client permits it because he trusts the lawyer. There are few more egregious acts of professional misconduct of which an attorney can be guilty than the misappropriation of a client's funds held in trust. Also, in looking at the ABA standards, the Office of Lawyer Regulation looked at mitigation and aggravating factors. In this case, Mr. Goldstein argues that he took funds out of the account because his monthly income had dropped by approximately 70%, and he was desperate to provide for his family, to get his son through college, and to pay their bills. However, if you look at the conversion in this case, it's very important to note that of the $69,500, only $21,871.19 went to creditors for payment. Most of those payments were to credit card companies. One was for a mortgage payment, and one was for a cable bill. and there might have also been some telephone bills paid with that those funds. The remaining funds of the $69,500 was to pay monies towards his business venture in Arizona, which is a significant amount of money. At one point, Mr. Goldstein wired $43,100 from his trust account to the Dixon Ryan PLC, a Phoenix law firm. He also, at another point, transferred $32,847.50 to individuals named the Majanskis, M-A-J-D-A-N-S-K-I-S, and he wired that money from his trust account in relation to his Scottsdale business venture. When looking at the total amount that he converted from his funds, a majority of that amount was for his business venture. It was not to help pay bills or keep up with funds. The OLR also considered that his actions were aggravated due to Mr. Goldstein's attempt to hide his conversions from the OLR during the OLR's investigation. During the proceeding, Mary Hafe Smith, OLR's investigator for and trust accounts expert, testified, but it wasn't until I had drafted an initial report that I realized that there was more to this story, that in fact funds hadn't been converted from three separate estates. And it's my belief, based upon my experience in investigating these cases, that Attorney Goldstein was attempting to prevent me from making that discovery, that his failure to produce records and his delay based upon his accountant's ability to put his new records together was all an effort to delay my ultimate discovery that there had been funds converted, and that's on the transcript at page 82. Another aggravating factor, as I already mentioned, was that a majority of the funds were used to pay towards his business venture and not personal bills or to help his son through college. It's also notable that Mr. Goldstein was ordered by the referee to reimburse the estate $3,000 in interest, and he has not yet reimbursed either the estate's those funds. Also, there was the potential for great harm in this case. There was no guarantee that Mr. Goldstein was going to be able to repay those funds at any certain point in time when he converted the funds as a fiduciary out of his trust account. Mary Hafe Smith testified that I believe there was a great potential for harm to the client if the Scottsdale property had not been sold. It would have been quite some time, and apparently Mr. Goldstein had a number of creditors who were seeking funds even as late as June 2005, the month before he received that settlement. If he could have held those creditors off until he received that payment, why take funds from the Coates estate? Why not simply wait until he received the funds for Scottsdale? The potential for harm was great in this case because of the amount of money that he would have needed to make whole the last client in the line of conversations, and it exposed that last estate to potentially $30-some thousand in loss. But again,
please finish. I have a question here.
That was just one aspect. The volume and the repeated conversions over a period of time, it wasn't a single isolated conversion. It was multiple conversions for multiple estates. And so that, too, increases the potential for harm merely by increasing the number of potential victims. And that's the transcript at pages 138 through 139. Justice Bradley?
Thank you. You started out by saying the question is what's the appropriate sanction in this case? And you cite cases to give guidance. Seems to me in the O'Byrne case, there was a significant prior discipline history. In the Rudolph case, the attorneys consented to revocation. In the Llewellyn case, revocation was entered on a default judgment. In the Landa case, there was also a consent to revocation, a voluntary license revocation. In the Krasisnik case, that's a little odd that you rely on, but after some stipulation with OLR and the referee not accepting it and the referee suggesting revocation would be better, because they were going to proceed under medical disability. Krasisnik then, while the case was pending before the court, submitted a petition, asking an indefinite medical suspension of his license and don't publish the revocation. So this person we have before the court now certainly isn't consenting to revocation, certainly isn't in default, certainly doesn't have any, after 31 years, prior disciplinary history. So why should his be revocation? There are cases that your opposing counsel cites for 1 or 2 years suspension.
Correct.
Krasinski, I think, was it 2 years? Maybe Nelson was too.
It's the OLR's position that the cases are more like the revocation cases. Mr. Goldstein's case is more like the revocation cases than the cases cited by my co-counsel. In the revocation cases, there's a significant amount of money. The attorneys were found to have violated Rule 8.4B, which is a theft, and they engaged in multiple counts of misconduct. If you look at the cases that have been cited by my co-counsel, for instance, the Krasinski, who received a 2-year suspension, this involved only one matter. He converted $37,094.42, which is significantly lower than the amount converted by Mr. Goldstein. And also, he fell behind on his bills and used majority of the money for car payments and credit cards. If you look at the Bolt case, which is a 2-year suspension, Mr. Bolt didn't have previous misconduct. He converted $37,000 and repaid all plus $4,500 in interest, which is significantly less than the amount converted by Mr. Goldstein.
My notes, I have to check my notes, but my net notes indicate that Bolt involved a sum of $74,000, but that might be incorrect.
Okay, I'm not sure. I may have added it up wrong. But with the Bolt matter, the court emphasized giving a 2-year suspension that he held the funds with the express authorization of the client. Also, this case involved a conversion from one client. It did not involve conversion from multiple clients. And also, he did repay it. In this case, there was no guarantee that Goldstein was going to be able to repay the funds. If he had not sold that property in Scottsdale, Arizona, he admits several times at the hearing that he would not have been able to repay the funds, and he probably would be in the midst of repaying the estates at this point in time.
Any other questions?
Looks like my time is up. Any further questions?
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Ms.
Thank
Scott.
You.
Craig Powell, representing Attorney Goldstein.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, ladies and gentlemen of the court, and may it please the court, my name is Craig Powell. I represent Harvey Goldstein in this matter. License revocation ought not be imposed indiscriminately in every case of misappropriation or conversion of client funds. This court made that declaration in the Bolt case we were just discussing 20 years ago. It holds true today. It's why we're here today. It's what this case is all about.
Now, the referee, this is really a sanctioned case.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with Your Honor's earlier comments regarding count 23. We've disputed that in the brief. I can rely on our brief in response to that. We think that it was not stipulated to by Mr. Goldstein. But even if it were, I think it would be a de minimis violation. And OLR has stated today that it would probably be worthy of a private reprimand, if anything. One comment about that, it's a particularly unusual relationship between Mr. Russo and Mr. Goldstein when it comes to agreements, in that these gentlemen have been doing business together for 25 years, continued doing business during the dispute over funds that gave rise to the grievance, and continue to do business to this day. As for what we're here today, I think, for the sanctions, the referee in this case, Judge Fiorenza, considered what are the mitigating facts of this case. And having looked Mr. Goldstein face to face at the hearing and listened to his sworn testimony in this matter, concluded that the ultimate sanction is not warranted in this case and something less, and his recommendation of 1 year suspension was appropriate. I think when taking that into account and the particular facts of this case as to Mr. Goldstein and the precedent we have discussed already in some fashion here this morning between Ms. Scott and the court, that Judge Fiorenza's recommendation ought to be adopted. Now, I say it's a mitigated case. Certainly we're talking about a substantial sum of money here. And just looking at those numbers, you don't say this is mitigated. But as the ABA guidelines recognize, it's not simply a matter of whether any money was converted or misappropriated. There's a background to everything. In this case, Mr. Goldstein, as he testified at the hearing to Judge Fiorenza, had been in private practice for over 20 years, decided to take an in-house counsel job with an auto financial group in Milwaukee, as a condition of which he had to close down his private practice. He had almost been done doing that and working for Automax Financial when they terminated or dissolved that company and terminated his position, leaving him now without a job and with a skeleton of what his former private practice was. And by Mr. Goldstein's own admission at the hearing, he panicked in a situation where his income instantly dropped by 70%. A son in college, family to support, based on how he had been living to the date. To that date, he made what are clearly inappropriate decisions and what he has always stated were inappropriate decisions with his trust account and clients' funds. But the most mitigating thing here, apart from the personal reasons for why this happened, is the harm or lack thereof in this case, actual harm to the clients involved. Monies were taken, some to pay personal bills, some put into a business venture, which I have some dispute with OLR about that. I think it's all part of the same thing. A business venture was meant to earn him more income, not just sort of a side venture as a hobby or something like that. It was intended to bring more income into Mr. Goldstein's coffers to support his family and his business, but in using those funds, they were replaced before any client knew they were missing. No client has ever complained to OLR about these actions. No client has ever complained to OLR about Mr. Goldstein's practice in 31
years. Counselor, I was curious about that, that they were all replaced before OLR got involved at all?
That's right.
Well, then how was it that OLR found that there were client funds that were misused?
In investigating the Russo grievance, which was filed by Mr. Russo regarding failure to pay for services of serving process, Ms. Hafe Smith, the investigator for OLR, had looked into Mr. Goldstein's trust account records, and I think during the course of that investigation noticed some anomalies that didn't fit, led her to look deeper, and then discovered the matters relating to these three estates.
Ah, I see. Thank you.
And Justice Rogancic, I agree with something you had mentioned before. One of the initial questions in this case was about whether this was an intentional theft, and there was no intent, no evidence of any intent to permanently deprive clients of any of this property, which is evidenced by the fact that all these funds were replaced prior to anyone noticing they were missing. If you look at the cases cited by OLR in support of revocation, some of which have just gone through by Justice Bradley, you see, I think, in every case, it's O'Byrne and Rudolph and Wright, in Lou Allen, in Martinez, you see no restitution made to these clients. These people were total loss of the money that was converted by their attorneys.
Counselor. Mr. Powell, what is the issue in regard to interest? I heard earlier the argument that he had been ordered to pay interest to the three clients, the three estates, and has not done so.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. At the hearing, when we approached, initially sat down for the hearing in this matter, we believed OLR was accusing Mr. Goldstein of owing over $13,000 that, and in their words, funds were unaccounted for from these estates. That turned out to be untrue. They were all accounted for. But the issue of interest was raised initially at the hearing, and Mr. Goldstein immediately said, I owe it, I'll pay it, let's calculate it right now. It was calculated on the record. You can see those calculations in the transcript stipulated to by Mr. Goldstein of an amount. I have $3,166. It is true Mr. Goldstein has not paid that restitution to date. I would note he's still sustaining significant costs in defending himself in this matter now on appeal, and he simply has not been able to pay that amount yet. He fully intends to pay it. It was an order of Judge Fiorenza's, assuming it will be an order of this court when the ultimate sanction is imposed, and it will be paid. That is the only outstanding restitution obligation in this matter.
One of your opposing counsel's arguments is that your client's behavior evinces a pattern of deception. It involves more than one client and involves more than one transaction with the several clients, or taking of money, not transaction. What about that? Does your client's misconduct reveal a pattern of deception?
Well, there's no dispute that it didn't happen once. This happened several times, three accounts involved a substantial amount of money. Now, in the course of time that this happened, 2003 into 2005, the issues with his job and the crumbling of his personal and business life happened in 2002 and precipitated all of this. So there was a pattern within what was going on here. Another pattern you see here, I think, is related to a complete sloppiness. Seems a little informal, but that's probably the best way to describe his attitude towards his trust account, record keeping, and everything else. Accounts 15 through 20 that Justice Abrahamson summarized at the beginning of this case. I don't think, while the actions in and of themselves were dishonest, without question, you don't see a pattern of dishonesty throughout Justice Goldstein's career. I think Judge Fiorenza was able to see him testify about these matters, judge for himself how he carried himself, whether he was being truthful and credible at the hearing, and looking at the findings of fact and decisions in Judge Fiorenza's ruling and recommendation, you see that he adopted or took Mr. Goldstein's testimony, credited for what it was
worth. How long a period was this taking?
I believe these three estates covered a time period between 2003 and 2005. Not all three of those estates were occurring simultaneously, but they were spread out over about a three-year period.
And were these estates terminated promptly, or were they held over, which gave them the opportunity to take the money?
I believe the estates were open right around a year, maybe a little over that. I don't practice probate law myself in Milwaukee. I'm afraid I can't tell the court the average time for probating an estate in Milwaukee, but the estates were finished with a complete accounting in the circuit court without objection. No clients filed any objections about delays, and no clients were asking the court or Mr. Goldstein, where's my money? You see some of those features in the cases cited by OLR in support of revocation, where clients are inquiring about their property and their money, and that's what precipitates the filing of these grievances. That never happened here. So I can't tell the court that that's an average or proper amount of time for a probate in Milwaukee County. I can tell you that no clients complained about the length of time those estates were open and pending.
Now, does Mr. Goldstein practice in the probate area, or is that outside the record? And if it's outside the record, don't.
That is outside. I believe that's outside the record, Your Honor. We were talking about a pattern of dishonesty, and I wanted to mention the record here at the hearing reflects some things about Mr. Goldstein's character, not just Judge Fiorenza's view of it, being able to watch him testify, but we also presented the testimony of two Milwaukee County Circuit Court judges, sitting judges, who testified under subpoena about their relationship with professional relationship with Mr. Goldstein, how they knew him to be honest and fair dealing, and how they dealt with him. One of those judges, Judge Kahn, a former BAPR prosecutor, said that while it was inappropriate for him to comment on what the sanction should be, he did not hesitate to offer the opinion that Mr. Goldstein should be able to practice law in the future. Judge Sosny offered that opinion also. And that's similar to the case of Britain that we cited, wherein there were substantial character references in support of Attorney Britain that resulted in a 90-day suspension of Attorney Britain's license for a conversion of about $12,000. There he had paid it back. Now, Sir Goldstein has never asked for a suspension of 90 days doesn't today. As been alluded to earlier in argument, our position has been from the outset that the precedent from this court would support a suspension of up to 2 years based on the facts in this case. The most significant mitigating fact is, of course, that monies that were converted were repaid without being missed.
I'm not sure how much to consider that as a mitigating factor. As a trial, prior to coming to this court, I was on the circuit court, and I only had a handful of embezzlement cases. A volunteer lady at a local church, bookkeeper at the Elks Club, all good families, good people, all had the intention of paying the money back. I don't think I had an embezzlement where there wasn't an intention to pay it back, but they just didn't. Then it was caught. Gambling problem, other problems. So, you know, he had the fortuitous situation that the money from Arizona came. Why should that it was paid back before it was discovered be a mitigating factor?
Well, I think Judge Sosny and Judge Kahn both touched on this at in their testimony at the hearing. I think we're talking about what is essentially a sentencing hearing here for Mr. Goldstein, comparable to what would occur in circuit courts, criminal law. You look at the whole picture of a person and the facts and circumstances of each case. As Judge Sosny noted, it would be very important for him to know whether or not what had been converted had ever been paid back, especially prior to sentencing. That would be a huge factor, I think, was Judge Sosny's term, in determining what the appropriate sanction would be for the individual that sits before him. Judge Kahn made the same comments. Now, whether it's fortuitous or something else, I don't know, but it was paid back in a timely fashion. And while OLR takes some issue with or points out that Mr. Goldstein says, well, yeah, I couldn't guarantee it was going to come back. And, find me someone who converts funds who can give a guarantee that it's going to come back. No one can guarantee it. It did happen in this case. He had some confidence in Wood. But as he said at the hearing, that doesn't excuse what he did. He's not offering excuses. He's offered explanations for what happened and describing the facts of what happened as in terms of how we should address how this court should address Mr. Goldstein going forward. I think looking at these ABA guidelines, which we've discussed to some degree here today, there's some other mitigating factors I haven't touched on, which first, he has no prior disciplinary record. We've discussed his personal problems. And his long career at the time, 28 years or so. Now he's at 31, 32 years of practice. No discipline. This is an aberrant conduct on the part of Mr. Goldstein. This, in this vacuum or this short bubble of time when this was going on, there was a pattern within that time frame. It's not a pattern that has covered the span of his legal career. And in its brief, OLR, one thing I want to address, alleged that Mr. Goldstein hasn't accepted responsibility, has refused to acknowledge the wrongful nature of his conduct. I just can't agree with that. If you look at his testimony in the hearing, you see at every opportunity he takes pains to say, I know what I did was wrong, I shouldn't have done it, this doesn't excuse what I did, and on and on. Not to mention he pled no contest to virtually all the counts except for the counts relating to Russo and one other. He has accepted responsibility, and he's put himself before the court, asking the court to adopt the referee's recommendation in this case. And based upon what we've discussed here today, the mitigating facts, importantly, the precedent from this court, where I think the cases cited by us in our briefs are much more on point factually and similar to Mr. Goldstein's situation than those cited by OLR, I think that's the appropriate outcome. I ask the court to impose it. If there are no further questions, I'll.
How old is this counsel?
Mr. Goldstein is 56 years old, been practicing since 1977. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Scott?
Thank you.
First, I would like to emphasize that the length of his practice is usually not a mitigating factor, but it's an aggravating factor because he has been practicing for so long, he should know better than to take money out of his clients' funds.
But he has no other issues of discipline against him in this length
no,
of time.
No, he does not. Okay. And but it does not excuse his misconduct in this case. And some of the cases cited in the revocation cases by the OLR, there is no previous discipline as well, such as the Rudolph case, the Wright case, the Lou Allen. I'm not sure about Lou Allen. Definitely in the Martinez case, there was no prior discipline. So this court can impose a revocation in this case due to the severity of his misconduct, despite the fact that he hasn't had any prior discipline. I would also like to emphasize that when we talk about the mental state of an attorney in regards to the injury that's defined by the ABA standards for imposing lawyer sanctions, the injury is defined by the type of duty violated and the extent of actual or potential harm. The ABA standards provide an example of intentional harm in the case where you assume that the client gave the lawyer $100 and as an advance against the cost of investigation. The lawyer took the money, deposited it in a personal checking account, and used it for personal expenses. In this case, where the lawyer acted intentionally and the client actually suffered an injury, the most severe sanction, disbarment, would be appropriate. Here, this is a case where I believe that the estates were open long enough for him to be able to take the money and replace the money without, and the clients never knew what happened. There were no grievances because the injured parties didn't know that there was money stolen out of their accounts. In terms of the judge's testimony, I would like to emphasize that they did state that Goldstein's license should be suspended, that this was serious misconduct. They said he should be able to get his license pointed back at some point. However, even in a revocation proceeding, his license is essentially a 5-year suspension, and he has a right to apply for reinstatement to the State Bar of Wisconsin. One of the judges, Judge Sanse, also, when he provided his testimony, had no information concerning the grievance matters involving Mr. Goldstein. Also, this is not a criminal case. This case is not subject to the sentencing standards as a criminal case. This is a civil case and subject to the Supreme Court rules concerning attorney discipline. This court really needs to look at the seriousness of Mr. Goldstein's misconduct. Mr. Goldstein was acting in a fiduciary capacity, holding money in trust for 3 estates. He intentionally converted the money from those estates without their knowledge or consent. This court also has to emphasize the fact that a majority of the funds did not go towards his personal bills. The panic concerning supporting his families does not excuse him from converting approximately $48,500 from his account to put towards his business venture. This court also needs to look at the fact that Goldstein was just lucky when he was able to repay the estate. If the market was down, if he was unable to sell the property in Arizona, he admits and agrees that he would not have been able to reimburse the estate and would probably at this point in time be in the process of making a payment on those funds. This is a serious case. This is not similar to the cases cited by co-counsel where there was conversions of money almost half the amount of what Mr. Goldstein converted. Neither of the attorneys engaged in 20 counts of misconduct, or 21, depending on this court's ruling. With Krasminski, he he fell behind on his bills. Bolt had expressed authorization from his clients to hold those funds. In Nelson, the court considered a mitigating factor that there was a gambling addiction. Britain case, the 90-day case, is an anomaly. There were very unique circumstances in that case that the court took into account with regard to that, and Ms. Schuster's case can be distinguished in that she was inept and only converted up to $5,000 at one point in time. Does the court have any other questions? I see my time's up.
I think not, Ms. Scott.
Thank you
for your arguments today. To Ms. Scott on behalf of the OLR, to Mr. Powell on behalf of Mr. Goldstein. And that ends our hearing in 07-18-2771D, OLR versus Goldstein. The court is in recess. I guess the court has now an adjournment on its oral argument calendar for December. The court will meet in closed conference at about 2 p.m. today. We are in recess. Justice Bradley, who when I checked my records said we found out earlier had offered to take over today for me because of this conflict. So she will meet with the students who are staying. So students may wait here. She will be right out.